Good morning. It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Joe McCarthy was a Major League Baseball manager. He managed teams to pennants in both the National and American Leagues. His teams won 7 World Series championships. He's best known for managing the Bronx Bombers, those New York Yankee teams of the 30s and early 40s. His famous 10 Commandments of Baseball are highlighted in a new book titled The 10 Commandments of Baseball, an affectionate look at Joe McCarthy's principles for success in baseball and life, published by Sporting Chance Press and written by J.D. Thorne, who joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning,
and,
John.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a great opportunity to be here.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and I'm really glad that I got a copy of it.
Thank you. First of all,
let's talk about how this book came to be, and first of all, your own baseball background.
Well, my own baseball background is that I came from a family of baseball players. There was a story in the family that my two grandfathers met at my parents' wedding in 1939, and that was the first time they had met. And after a few glasses of beer at the reception in the basement of my maternal grandfather's home, that the two men figured out that they had both pitched against each other in a hardball game, probably in about 1910. So I have baseball coming at both sides. My father was an excellent baseball player, not professional, but in the high amateur leagues and the church leagues in the 1930s in Chicago. And I grew up playing baseball and hearing stories from my father's exploits. And my brother also played baseball. He was a little bit better than me, I think, about 5 years ahead of me, and he became a high school coach for 34 years in the Arlington Heights area of Chicago. I went on to play for the University of Wisconsin. The book came to be, really, when my father passed away. We found among his effects a copy of an advertising card from an Iowa restaurant. The card itself had on one side of it a picture of the proprietor, who was a pitcher for the New York Yankees, not of any real great renown, but still you're pitching for the New York Yankees, so that's pretty good shooting. And after he retired from baseball, he went back home to Iowa, opened up a baseball-themed restaurant, had a great life, and my father stopped there. It was in the Amana colonies of Iowa. And we figured out that my folks had stopped there probably in about 1975. When my father passed away in about 2002, we figured he had had this card in his top dresser drawer of his bedroom chest of drawers for over 25 years.
So you found the card. Then what happened?
Well, I thought to myself, I'm going to do something with this. And I put it on my desk at my law office, and I received a call. I do some speaking, and I received a call for one of those talks that you really have to do when you get the opportunity to do it. And I wasn't paid for it. I had to drive up to Duluth, Minnesota, but the idea was I was asked to do a presentation to the federal prison camp in Duluth to their positive mental attitude development class, which, of course, is very important for the prisoners. I thought about what to talk about, and I looked at the card on my desk, and I said, tell you what, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'll figure it out, but entitled the talk, The Ten Commandments of Baseball. Because it occurred to me that these not only apply to success in baseball, they also apply to success in life as well, when you think about them the right way.
Well, before we go on, here's another entry in the Small World file. I used to teach speech at that prison camp.
Oh, my goodness.
And in Duluth, they refer to it in some circles as Camp Walkaway, because the only gate is for cars to get in and out. There's no fence around the camp.
Right.
It's an interesting place. But, yeah, I used to teach public speaking there. So you gave this speech. Take us from there to turning this into a published book.
Well, the speech went over so well. The prior speaker to me was Jim Tressel. He's the head football coach at Ohio State. I thought that I received 2 standing ovations from the group when I went through it. I had 1 hour. We were kind of, you probably are familiar with the theater that's there. And it was an interesting group to talk to. At first, to me it was kind of an amusing story. I started by reading a little letter that I had written to my father, And before he passed away, talking about life and things that I had thought about that I wanted to discuss with him, and part of it was I had seen once on a Memorial Day service at a cemetery in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, there was an inscription in front of the church before you walk through the threshold, and the inscription was, which always impressed me, was, "The good men do lives after them." So I said that to the group. There were about 300 inmates that were there, and a hand shot up at the back of the room. They said, "Oh, that's Shakespeare." And I said, "Well, you're close. The real quote from Shakespeare is from Julius Caesar, and it's Mark Antony's funeral oration. But the quote is, 'The evil men do lives after them,' referring to the Roman Senate who had just murdered Julius Caesar." Well, that got the attention of the crowd, and I kind of had him after that. So it was very exciting. What happened after that is that I thought I knew I had something there. So I started slowly putting down my thoughts behind each commandment. I started researching the Ten Commandments and Joel McCarthy himself. I was connected with the National Baseball Hall of Fame, who was a terrific help for me. When I looked at McCarthy's record, oddly enough, it was someone that he was just a little bit before my time, and I didn't really know about him. And then when I looked him up in a baseball book I had, it said, highest winning percentage of any manager ever, managing 24 years, the three most storied franchises, although sometimes when I'm giving presentations, I say, "Is there anybody in the group from St. Louis?" I don't want you to be offended here. He didn't manage for St. Louis, but he did manage the Chicago Cubs, the New York Yankees, and the Boston Red Sox. Pretty hard to do better than that.
Well, you know, that's three pretty famous franchises. He, in addition to having the highest winning percentage all time by a manager, which was 615, he also, his postseason record is 698 All World Series games, and that's also a major league high. Joe McCarthy was an incredibly successful manager. He turned around the Cubs when he took them over. He inherited a pretty good Yankees team. You have to at least say that.
Well, they hadn't really won the pennant though for a number of years until he took them over. They'd won it in 1927, of course, with the murderer's row. But then in 1929, 30, and 31, the World Series really belonged to Connie Mack's Philadelphia A's. So when McCarthy took the Yankees over, they hadn't been able to, despite all the talent that they had, weren't able to quite put it together as well as some of the other teams. So, but in short order, I think there was a quote that I found that said, well, I know there was. McCarthy was interviewed and said, "I would jump off the Brooklyn Bridge if the New York Yankees could meet the Chicago Cubs, his old team in the World Series." And sure enough, that's what happened in 1932.
And did he jump off the bridge?
You know, that part, I don't think he did, because he went on to continue to manage them until 1946.
Yeah. And, of course, I mean, he was there with, you know, people like Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and that whole, you know, a lot of famous ball players. They got the big press. When I first saw this, Joe McCarthy, who the heck is Joe McCarthy? And then it dawned on me, yes, baseball manager. Okay. And then it clicked. I can't say that I'm a huge baseball fan, but I'm old enough to, not to have been alive when he was managing the Yankees. I'm not going to go there, but, you hear about things, my father talking about baseball and so forth. Then it was interesting to go in and then read something about him and his style of managing. I mean, he had a lot of big personalities. Some I would think Babe Ruth was a tough guy to manage.
Well, that's very true, and that was one of the unique characteristics that people ascribed to Joe McCarthy's ability as a manager. He was a very smart psychologist of people, and that stemmed from probably his years of managing in the minor leagues. In fact, when he wrote the Ten Commandments of baseball, he was a minor league manager, as I came to learn. He wrote these in 1921. my own vision was sort of, this was something he probably came up with at the end of his career, and I could envision him on a traveling train talking to the beat writer for the Boston Herald or something, and the writer asked him, well, what do you subscribe your success to? But it wasn't like that at all. McCarthy had been a minor league player, but he was also known as a good student of the game. And as time went on, he was asked to, he was captain of teams, and then he was player manager of teams. And then there was a cute story I ran across that he was managing the Louisville Colonels, and one of the, he was playing second base, and the shortstop was a young man, and he was trying to teach the shortstop something about doing the double play. And the young man looked at him and said, listen, old man, get off the field. You're taking the spot of somebody else who should be playing and learning how to do this himself. And with that, McCarthy said, you know, he said to himself, you know, you're right. I shouldn't be playing too. And so then he became strictly a bench manager. In 1921, the Louisville Colonels were very successful. They won the American Association Championship and then were playing in the Minor League World Series against a team from Baltimore who was heavily favored, and his team from Louisville, who were known for their inside game. In other words, players always, if there was a hit to the outfield, the outfielders threw to the cutoff man and hit the cutoff man. If they were running the bases, they didn't get thrown out trying to stretch a hit. If they had to lay down a bunt, they got the bunt down and moved the runners up. So they played smart baseball. He was able to instill that in his players. He was a great teacher of the game. So when it came time, they played this World Series, and sure enough, they won. Now, if you think about it, John, 1921, that's even before the age of radio. This was entertainment. So when he came back to Louisville, as I read about the formation of the Ten Commandments, there was quite a lot of partying. I imagine there were a few bets that were placed on the World Series by some of the backers, and they had won those bets because the team won the Little World Series. And out of the hoopla of that, 3 or 4 weeks after doing that in September of 1921, came these Ten Commandments of baseball, and then they were published and even read from the pulpit of the churches. And because you might think that might be a little sensitive, using the phrase Ten Commandments of, and yet using terms from baseball, but it was so well received. So it was a great, it was just a great thing. And he used these commandments throughout his career. There was just no question about it that this was part of his training regimen for the players.
Well, I want to talk about those Ten Commandments and have us have a discussion about them and to have you share your reflections on these as well. But we're going to take a break first, and when we come back, we'll do that. I'll also invite people to join us as we discuss the Ten Commandments of baseball as laid down by the late Joe McCarthy, a manager of at one time the Chicago Cubs, later the New York Yankees, and finishing his career with the Boston Red Sox. J.D. Thorne has written a new book called The Ten Commandments of Baseball, an affectionate look at Joe McCarthy's principles for success in baseball and in life. And we're going to talk about how these baseball commandments, aphorisms would be another thing, that a phrase that you or word you could use instead if the term commandment makes you uncomfortable, how they apply to everyday life. Anyway, we're going to do that. We'll start that process after we take a short break, and then we'll be back with more from J.D. Thorne and the Ten Commandments of Baseball. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:21. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Here is the toll-free number you can call to join the program, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you'd prefer to send an email, the address is talk@wpr.org. My guest is J.D. Thorne, who is the author of The Ten Commandments of Baseball, an affectionate look at Joe McCarthy's principles for success in baseball and in life, published by Sporting Chance Press. You can find out more about the book at www.sportingchancepress.com. Let's talk about those Ten Commandments of baseball. And being a linear thinker, I'll just go right to the top and start with number one. Joe McCarthy says, nobody ever became a ball player by walking after a ball.
Isn't that terrific? I just, to me, when I looked at that, I said, that is exactly right. I always thought of like two players playing catch, and a ball gets away from one of the players. Now, your tendency is to just walk over to get the ball. Maybe it's lying 20, 30 feet away, and saunter over and pick the ball up. But what does a ball player do? Someone who wants to become a ball player, they run over there. They hustle. They pick it up. They make a game out of it. They fake it like they're making a double play, and they throw the ball back to the other fellas. They're warming up. They hustle. And I believe that's what this commandment means to me. Nobody ever became a ball player by walking after a ball. You run after a ball. You hustle. You learn the hustle habit. Then when you're between the lines, that comes naturally to you without thinking. When I started to say, well, what ball players really kind of implemented that that kind of commandment? And the first one that came to mind was Ty Cobb. When we were researching it, there were some wonderful quotes that came up. There was one that we put into the book. It's a Ty Cobb. He is much too wild and reckless to keep his arms, legs, and head intact. and he played that way. When you look at his records, I was amazed to learn that he actually stole home 54 times in his career. Everybody talks about him having the highest batting average of anybody, but he also had the stolen base record. I think there was a statistic I recently saw that it was over 80 times in his career where he got on first base, stole second base, stole third base, and then stole home. Now, that's hustle.
Wow.
The other part of it is that he used an interesting grip on his bat, and we have a wonderful picture that we got from the Hall of Fame showing that grip, and he used a wide grip. He may have had even 2 or 3 inches between the top hand on the bat and the bottom hand on the bat, and that allowed him terrific bat control. So he would punch out singles and doubles and triples, but then there was a funny story that I ran across that a sports writer looked at Ty Cobb and he said, aren't you a little jealous of all the attention being paid to that Babe Ruth over in New York? He's hitting all those home runs. And Ty Cobb said, well, hitting home runs, that's easy. All I do is slide my top hand down to the bottom hand, grip the bat at the bottom of the bat, and I can hit home runs. And so they made a bet. Well, the next two games, Ty Cobb did exactly that and hit 5 home runs over 2 games. Won his bet, and then he went back to his old grip. And he told the reporter, I think it's better this way for the team. I help the team more by having a higher batting average than I do by knocking out home runs. So he, of course, led the major leagues and with an incredible .367 career average. He won the batting title 12 consecutive years. He was in the first group of inductees into the Baseball Hall of Fame. So I guess it worked for him.
Well, and this kind of, you know, the hustle rule is one that applies pretty much to every sport, whether it's baseball or if you're in, you know, in basketball, you always want to hustle after the loose ball because the team that does that the best is generally the one that comes out on top at the end of the game. The same rule applies to hockey. You know, if you don't, you have to skate to the puck. You don't just stand there and wait for it to show up. And I would think just about any sport, the harder you're willing to work, the more successful you'll be.
Well, that's exactly it, John. And there were some great other players. I thought of Enos Slaughter, who was a player for the St. Louis Cardinals. And when I researched him, I came across a quote that he at one time was playing in the minor league, in the Sally League in 1936 for the Columbus, Georgia Redbirds. And he was rebuked by his manager for not hustling. Well, he vowed to himself never again to walk while on the playing field. And he rose through the minor leagues to become one of the leader and top hitters on the 1942 Cardinals World Series championship team, and then again in 1946. And then his claim to fame was that he scored from first base on a single in Fenway Park. He was running on the pitch, so he's almost at second base. And then this was in the late innings of the sixth game of the World Series, and he never stopped around third base. And there was some miscommunication by the Cardinal or the Boston Red Sox left fielder or center fielder to the shortstop Johnny Pesky, who hesitated just briefly on his throw to home, and by golly, Enos Slaughter beat the throw. But what got me was before the game, I read that he had a conversation with the team physician, and the team physician told him, he said, "Enos, your arm is hurt so badly that if you injure it even more today by playing in this game, I might have to amputate it." And Enos looked at him and said, "Well, Doc, I guess that's a gamble we'll just have to take." And that was the game that he scored from first base on a single to win the game and win the World Series for the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, that's hustle. So how do we translate this hustle? You mentioned to regular life. You mentioned basketball. I once did a brainstorming exercise for a high school basketball team. I said to the players, I said, "How many are on the baseball team?" And about half the hands went up. I said, "Well, the rest of you fellas, you all played Little League baseball. You know baseball rules." They said, "Yeah," and all the rest of the hands went up. And I said, "Well, let's take these and apply these to basketball." And so we said, no one ever became a ball player by walking after a ball. What does that mean? That means hustle. Well, how do we hustle in basketball? And one of the young men shouted out, "Well, that's diving on the floor for a loose ball, just like what you just said, John." Another fellow shouted out, "Oh, that's screening out my man for a rebound. That takes hustle." And a third fellow said, "Getting an offensive rebound. That's what really takes hustle." So I said, "There you have it. 1, 2, 3. And then we went on to the second commandment.
Yeah, again, you know, the harder you're willing to work, the more success you'll have. And not only work on the during the game, but work at improving your game and acquiring skills. It's been an aphorism of mine that skill beats talent if talent doesn't have skill.
Oh, you're exactly right. There are many ball players that I think Craig Counsell with the Milwaukee Brewers is a prime example of hustle. He's always doing the right thing, and he's very intent on his play. I was lucky when I was a young lad learning how to play. I was 14 years old, and I had a coach that also taught me how to chatter. So in the book, I talked about chatter, and it's something that practically everyone does, but it's really not a hey better swing. The best chatter is never directed at the opposition. It's only talk between your own teammates while you're on the field of play. You're cheering on your teammates. It's always positive. You're cheering on your pitcher, and you might say, "Hey, 2-2, rock and fire, let's throw that pill, let's get that over the plate." And then you might think of something to say, and you might yell out to the shortstop, "Okay, if it's a ground ball hit to you, let's get two. Let's get a double play." And all of a sudden, maybe the third baseman will chime in and say, "If it's a hit to left field, I've got the cutoff." And you're communicating. Now think of that as to how we operate in business. How can we communicate with our team members in business? How can we chatter with them? You keep it positive. You never talk about the opposition. I remember one time pitching in a game in Madison, and we were playing for the city championship. And in some times, as you know, in amateur baseball, different things happen, and I tell about these stories in the book. In this particular case, we were winning by one run, but the other team had the bases loaded, and up came a pinch hitter. And sometimes he probably went to the park not expecting to play, and they gave him a uniform, and he got up to the plate, and he was still wearing his Bermuda shorts. So all of a sudden, our shortstop pipes out, and he says, "Oh, he can't hit. He's wearing shorts." And I thought to myself, "Oh, no." And sure enough,
yeah, thanks a lot.
Pitches later, he lined a fastball right over the shortstop's head for a single to drive in the two winning runs, and we lost the game. I mean, ouch, that still hurts today when I think about it.
Yeah, why give the other team any motivation?
Right. But I think chattering is a way that we can hustle, talking with each other, keeping it positive, and reminding each other what needs to be done.
Let's talk about commandment number two. You will never become a 300 hitter unless you take the bat off your shoulder.
Well, I think that's pretty good, too. To me, this means act. You have to do something. You know, you can't make an omelet unless you crack the egg. You have to do something. You have to make something happen. The tendency you might think when you're a young man playing baseball, or even if you're playing amateur baseball, if I get a walk, that's a good thing. But if you go up to the plate looking for a walk, first of all, you probably won't get one, and second of all, it's never as good as a base hit up the middle. There's nothing like good hitting is contagious, and it inspires the rest of the team. So you have to act. When I did this with the basketball team, that came out translated as shoot when you have the shot.
Yeah.
So how do we dovetail this to life? I mean, I got a kick out of, there was a quote from Babe Ruth. They asked him, well, Babe, how do you explain your science of hitting? And Babe responded, all I can tell you is that I pick a good one and sock it. I get back to the dugout, and they ask me what it was I hit, and I tell them, I don't know, except it looked good. And I think there's a lot to that. You go up there swinging. When I thought of current-day ball players, Vladimir Guerrero, who's a free agent now, but he's had a terrific career with the Los Angeles Angels, and I saw a quote from him, and he said, they asked him his style of hitting. He said, if something looks good, I'm swinging. They pay me to hit. I look at the ball and swing. Of course, you can't argue with his results. He's been hitting over 300 and driving in runs for 5-6 years for Los Angeles Angels. So, and they've made the playoffs many of those years and won a championship as well. So you go up there to hit.
An old hockey coach friend of mine used to say, 100% of the shots you don't take won't go into the net.
That's exactly it.
If you want to score, you got to shoot.
Well, one of the things I talk about too, that I recalled from my playing days was fear. Sometimes fear keeps you from acting. Fear of failure, and I think that's one of the most difficult lessons to overcome. Now, I remember being in high school, and we had I played in a very competitive league, and one of the other teams had a pitcher who was clocked at throwing the ball 97 miles an hour. Well, you get up to the plate with somebody throwing 97 miles an hour, you might get a little shy. The idea there was to remind yourself that, well, if the ball is heading for my head, that's probably the most vulnerable to injury, but it's actually the easiest part of the body to get out of the way. Batters do it instinctively. So you kind of have to have a little confidence. That's part of this, take your bat off the shoulder. According to Ty Cobb, he said, every great batter works on the theory that the pitcher is more afraid of him than he is of the pitcher. So you go up there to swing. I can remember once, and it may not even apply to hitting. I mean, you're trying to make something happen. After I was in law school and I graduated from law school, I had the opportunity in Madison to play for a baseball team. And my very first game, we were playing in the old Bree Stevens Field. Now, many people have probably played there. Now they just play soccer there. But we used to also play baseball there. And it was an old park, once used as a minor league park. It was built by the CCC. And it was a great, fun place to play. So my very first game, my second at bat, and I hadn't played hardball baseball since I'd played for the University of Wisconsin in about 6 years. I never really thought I'd play hardball again. My second at bat, I knocked a double into the gap. I'm standing on second base. A fellow hit a ground ball over to I moved over to third base. And as I'm standing on third base, it was really that field of dreams feeling. I was just so happy to be playing ball again. I'm on third base. And when you were on third base at Bree Stevens Field, and if you look towards home, right behind was the state capitol. Well, it was a night game and was all lit up. There was a big full moon floating by the state capitol. And I thought, oh, this is like Field of Dreams. I'm in heaven. Only it's not Iowa. It's Madison.
Doesn't get much better than that.
Well, right. And so then the next thought, well, let's pay attention to the game here. And I took a long lead off third base. And I wanted to get as close to home as I could. If the ball got away, then I could score. The First pitch came in, and I noticed that the pitcher wasn't paying any attention to me at all. We were winning the game about 5-2 at the time. It was about the fifth inning of a seven-inning game. There were two outs. I thought to myself as I went back to the bag at third base, I wonder how far I can really get off the bag. So for the second pitch, I was way off the bag, and again, the pitcher wasn't paying any attention to me. So after the pitch came in, the batter didn't swing. I was going out back to third base. I thought to myself, gee, I might be able to steal home. Now, I was not necessarily the fastest player on the team, but I decided my second thought after I thought that I might be able to steal home was, gee, if I don't do it on this pitch, that hitter's likely to swing and hit the ball, and I'll never have this chance again. So the third pitch came in, and I'm way off the bag, and there's a technique, what you call a walking lead, where what you're trying to do is have momentum going towards home. But when the pitcher, usually he'll take a little glance over to you, and when you if you time that just right, you appear as if you're standing still, and then you take off towards home plate once he gets into the rest of his windup. Well, I did that, and he glanced over to me. I was kind of looked like I was standing still, but I really had my momentum going toward home plate, and then I took off like a tiger towards home. And the pitcher saw this, and he what they call a quick pitch. He speeded up his motion. It really should have been called a balk, but it surprised everybody, including the umpire. So the umpire didn't call it. The pitch came in. It was high and outside, and I came sliding into head first into home plate, and then the dust, and the catcher caught the ball and dove towards home plate, and it surprised everybody, and the umpire looked, and he goes, out. And now I'm thinking, oh, no. My first game with a new team, the coach is going to think I'm some sort of a madman. And I got over to the bench, and the coach, the great Ernie Bruns, was our coach, and he was an attorney in Madison for many, many years, and just a wonderful man. And he looked at me, and he was grinning ear to ear, and he said, that's the funniest thing I've seen in years. Get your glove and get out there. Don't worry about it. And we went on to win the game. But, you know, I played amateur ball with him for another 15 years, and in all that time, not once did I ever have the chance to steal home again.
Well, you have to take your opportunities when they arise. I think that's the lesson there.
That's it. You got to take your bat off the shoulder if you're going to hit 300.
Yeah. We'll take a break. We've got a caller who wants to join us, and maybe some more behind that one. 800-642-1234. We're talking about the Ten Commandments of Baseball. It's a new book by J.D. Thorne. It's an affectionate look at Joe McCarthy's principles for success in baseball and in life, published by the Sporting Chance Press. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. If you'd prefer to send us an email, the address is talk@wpr.org. Don't go away. We've got eight commandments left. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 10:41, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. This hour, we're talking to J.D. Thorne, author of The Ten Commandments of Baseball, an affectionate look at Joe McCarthy's principles for success in baseball and in life. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program, as Laura in Whitewater has done. Let's take that call now. Laura, thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me. Hi, J.D.
Hi, Laura.
How are you?
Terrific.
I don't want to skip too far ahead because I don't know exactly what commandment this is. I haven't read your book or anything. It's the first time I've heard about it. But I'm just wondering what commandment would speak to ethics and business and fairness and sportsmanship.
Well, that is a great question. And the answer is there is a commandment, and it's the Tenth Commandment. The Tenth Commandment is a pitcher who hasn't control hasn't anything. So to me, this dovetails to self-control. And there are baseball stories that exemplify the principle, but one of the ones I finished the book with is the story about Buck Weaver. Now, Buck Weaver, probably no one's ever heard his name, maybe a few have, but if you ever watch the movie Eight Men Out, which is a great baseball movie, it's about the Chicago Black Sox scandal in 1919. where 8 players were banned from baseball for life. You always hear about Shoeless Joe Jackson, and some people think that's unfair. But Shoeless Joe took the money. He may have played just as hard as he normally would have played in the World Series, but he took the money from the gamblers. When the scandal broke and the investigation took place, Buck Weaver was the shortstop. He was the 8th man. Only 7 men actually took money from the gambler from New York. The 8th man was Buck Weaver. The 7 men invited Buck Weaver into the scandal because they knew he needed money too. The owner of the White Sox was notoriously cheap, and the players were mad at him. So they offered the opportunity to Buck Weaver, and he said, no, 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 I don't want anything to do with it. You know, like Dracula looking at the cross, I don't want anything to do with it. So why was he banned? He was banned because he knew about it but didn't snitch. Now, to me, if you give this commandment another little spin, from self-control, it goes to business ethics. So what do you do when you're an employee and you're in a situation or an owner or something that isn't quite right? You think of Enron. I remembered also there was a scandal years ago with the oil leases in the Oklahoma branch of the Continental Bank. Well, there was one employee who kept on writing letters and memos to the people in Chicago from Oklahoma saying something isn't right here. Well, when the scandal broke, she was promoted. So I think business ethics, and so it's a great question, Laura, really is a pitcher without control has anything, and it means you have to stay in control of what you're doing, both on the field and in your professional life. Otherwise, you really haven't anything.
Laura, thanks for
one thing, John, I just want to say this, and to me, if the message could go out to what happened to Buck Weaver is that he really got in over his head with something, and he tried to shoulder the burden alone. If you find yourself in a situation like this, the advice is talk to someone. It could be a parent, it could be an uncle, it could be a pastor or a priest, it could be an attorney, but talk to someone. Don't try and go it alone when you get in over your head. And this was certainly not something that Buck Weaver brought on himself, but he found himself in a bad situation, and it did not work out for him. No commissioner ever has reinstated Buck Weaver, even though he did not take any money and played his usual slick fielding shortstop and good hitting in the World Series itself.
800-642-1234. Thanks to Laura for that phone call. Maybe you have a question. We've talked about, I think a couple of other commandments might also respond to Laura's question as well. Number 6, do not alibi on bad hops. Anybody can field the good ones. One of the things we see people do a lot is make excuses for their behavior. It's not my fault. It was my parents didn't raise me right, or my teacher didn't teach me right, or I got a bad break, instead of, taking what's in front of you and dealing with it.
John, that's a terrific observation. There was a quote I found from Christy Mathewson. They called him a gentleman. He was the gentleman ball player. And when I'm giving presentations and talks, I like to point out that why did they call him gentleman? That's because he pitched from 1900 to about 1920, and again was one of the early inductees in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And they called him Gentleman Christy Mathewson because he had not one but 2 years of college at Bucknell. It gives you an idea of how fortunate we are today to have the educational system that we do and the opportunity to learn. But he had an interesting observation. His observation was the quote I found. He said, "You must have an alibi to show why you lost." I thought that was kind of unusual for him to say. "If you haven't won, you must fake one. Your self-confidence must always be maintained. Always have that alibi. But keep it to yourself. That's where it belongs."
Mm-hmm.
So
It's always easy to make excuses and point the finger of blame elsewhere. It's a little harder and requires a little more character to say, you know what, I blew that.
You're exactly right, John.
The let's take another one here. The other one I was thinking of, do not find too much fault with the umpires. You cannot expect them to be as perfect as you are. That's the ninth commandment. But I wanted to be sure to talk about that one, and we've got about 10 minutes left of the show, and I want to make sure we get to it because, boy, I'll tell you what, these days it's all about we need every call needs to be perfect, and to ensure that we want to put in instant replay for baseball, and I wanted to talk to you about that. But let's talk about that commandment. Do not find too much fault with the umpires. You cannot expect them to be as perfect as you are. A little tongue-in-cheek there from manager McCarthy.
Isn't it great? When I gave the brainstorming session with the basketball team, the coach just lit up when I got to that commandment. And he said, to me, that is humility. Now, I like to think it also maybe is a little bit of respect for authority. There's a old saying in baseball, too, is don't let the umpire take your bat. You know, you swing the bat, don't let the umpire make the call. I think the lesson here is you play the game, and if the umpires make a bad call, which they're bound to do, that's part of the game. You have to live with that and overcome that. I remember those lessons, especially as a pitcher. Sometimes you'd get upset when you threw a ball that you thought was a perfect strike, and the umpire calls it a ball. There was a wonderful little story from Del Crandall that we talk about in the book. I heard him give this at the Milwaukee Athletic Club, and he said it was his first major league game. 1950, he was playing in Boston for the Boston Braves. He said he was in the minor leagues. A young man, like 20 years old, 21 years old, and he was playing in Evansville, Indiana. He was originally from California. So he got the call in August to come up to the major leagues, to the big club in Boston. And as soon as he hung up the phone in the clubhouse, he called home, and his mother answered the phone. He said, Mom, I'm going to Boston. And she said, what for? He said, let me talk to Dad. And but the Boston Braves were very nice, and they you think about 1950, it was a transcontinental flight from California to Boston, but they flew his parents out to Boston, and there they are for his very first game, sitting with the club president and in the lower box seats in Fenway Park, or the park where Boston, the Braves played. And so the first pitch comes in. He says, I want to keep this simple, and I put down one finger call for the fastball. I put my glove in the bottom of the strike zone, and sure enough, I don't even move the glove. This is the major leagues. The ball comes in. It's right there. And the famous umpire, Jock O'Conlon, goes ball one. Well, Crandall said, I thought that was a little funny. I threw the ball back. Now my pitcher's got a 1-0 count, and so I put my one finger down for the fastball, call for that again. I put my glove in the bottom of the strike zone right behind the plate, and same thing. I don't move the glove an inch. It's right there. And Jock O'Conlon says, ball two. Ball two. So Crandall said, as I'm throwing the ball back to the pitcher, my jaw starts to move a little bit, only so that the umpire can hear me. And I say, gee, those look like two pretty good pitches to me. And at that, Jock O'Conlon calls timeout. He goes around the plate to dust off home plate. And, of course, there was no dust on the plate because the batter hadn't swung. There had only been two pitches. That wasn't it. And as he's dusting off home plate, he looks Crandall right in the eye, and he says, listen, Bushleaguer, I'll call the balls and strikes. And Crandall said he looked right back at Jock O'Conlon and said, you can stick that Bushleaguer right where the sun don't shine. And at that, Jock O'Conlon says, that's it. You're out of here. And he threw him out of the game after two pitches. He said, I could just imagine my mother talking to my father, well, why is Dell walking to the dugout and taking off his equipment? The game just started. At any rate, he said that's my introduction to the major leagues.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't accomplish very much by complaining about calls, whatever the sport. But sometimes it is difficult not to.
I just want to say one thing, John, with the basketball team. What happened is they adopted these commandments as sort of their code, and it was respect for the referees. And I saw the team play several times, and whenever there was a call, they just put the ball down on the floor and ran down the other way. Well, you know what happens after a while? Word gets around as to how you treat the referees, and then all of a sudden you start to get the calls.
It always pays to be nice to the umpire. Let's take some calls. We've got some people who want to join us now. We'll go to William in Sun Prairie first. William, good morning.
Good morning. I was a great basketball coach, high school coach, in another state. When he was a young fellow, he was a farm boy chopping wood. He chopped off his thumb. So anyway, his team was for championship in the state. And he said to the team, stuck up his left hand, I want five good men to win the championship. How do you use a disadvantage to an advantage?
There you have it. I think that there's several commandments that might apply in one respect. I think of commandment number four, which is keep your head up and you may not have to keep it down, which I think contains sort of an element of being alert and staying alert, and then also don't get discouraged. Now, I'm sure that the coach who chopped off his thumb must have had a tough, he was probably a pretty good athlete if he became a coach. And as you say, William, that's just a terrific lesson. Stay in the game. Or maybe it's commandment number eight, which is do not quit.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the call, William. Let's go to Mike in Lake Geneva next. Mike, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Hey, J.D., I had the opportunity to have lunch with you a little while ago, and made the comment, you might remember, that a lot of these principles apply to business.
Right.
And I don't think you hear that often enough where to be successful in business, you have to apply these principles of fair play. And to be truly successful, you have to develop the ability to work with other people.
Well, another one I think for business, too, especially, is commandment number seven, which is always run them out. You can never tell. And all too often we might have a project in business and we just we get three-fourths of the way there and then we just say, oh, this is never going to work, and we stop. Where if we'd just gone a little further, just applied a little more willpower to it, and the project would succeed. You know, that's really how you separate yourself from the others, is doing the things that the others can't or won't do.
Well, and there's a principle of sales involved there, too. My father was a terrific salesman for many years. He sold radio broadcast advertising, as a matter of fact. His favorite aphorism was always let the customer say no. If you assume, oh, they'll never buy this, well, then they won't. But, you know, you make them put it out there and see what happens. Put the ball in play. Let's see what happens. If you don't, well, you'll never know.
That's a great aphorism, John.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We won't get through all 10 of the commandments, and of course we want to leave people with an excuse to read the book anyway. But what was the most important thing you feel you learned as you went through the process of writing this book? You did the research about Joe McCarthy. You read the Ten Commandments and looked for examples of how they played out in baseball players and in life. And you've got a lot of illustrations from your own experience as well. What's the most important thing you think you learned in all of this?
Well, I would probably go to the idea that this book has been sort of a gift to me, and it's been an idea. Actually, much of the research was when I started talking about the idea and working through how I would approach talking about it. People started encouraging me to keep going, and people started giving me things for research. Almost all the research in the book was from things that people gave me. And it took 5 years, really, from the concept and the speech at the prison camp in Duluth to the actual book. There were times that I was tempted to give up, and then something would happen. So I think what I learned is to just keep at it and don't stop. As a matter of fact, my next project with this is I think it would make a perfect movie. I've worked on a screenplay, and I'm keeping at it, and then the more and more I talk about it, as wild as a dream that might be, if I keep dreaming and I keep working at it when the time is right, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We like Russell Crowe playing Joe McCarthy.
Yeah, who's going to play you?
Well, I don't know. We'll have a narrator, and maybe that'll be fun. But but I think dream big.
Well, go big or go home. That seems to be a business adage. You know, if you're going to do something, do it. I think one of the commandments, and we don't have time to really talk about it, but when you start to slide, slide. Once you make that commitment, you're keep going. And we're out of time. That's one of the things that doesn't happen in a baseball game. You're out of innings, but not out of time. It happens in other sports. We've run out of time for this hour. But J.D. Thorne, thank you so much for spending this time sharing about your book with us.
Well, thank you very much, John. I would just like to encourage listeners, if they wanted to learn more about it, go to the Sporting Chance Press website, sportingchance.com, sportingchancepress.com, all one word. And there's lots of information there. There's how you can buy the book on the website with a PayPal, and it's $20. And I think it's packed with information. And I've been given letters from people who, in fact, one letter I got from a person, the book is sold at the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum store, a fact of which I'm very proud. And I got a letter from someone who just loved the book.
And we need to leave it there. Thanks a lot. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.